You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Really excited for you to listen to this episode of the podcast. It's with Aaron McGough, who is an award-winning filmmaker and content creator known as the Internet's Big Sister through her Advice with Aaron branding. She received a Pulitzer Fellowship in 2017 and was named a Forbes 30 Under 30 recipient in 2025. And she's got a great new book. It's called The Secret Language of Work, Hyper Helpful Scripts for Every Situation. Enjoy the pod. Aaron McGough, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So let's start with your story, because it's 2020 and you're living in a 400 square foot apartment in Brooklyn during the pandemic. So everyone can relate.
Yeah.
You decide to post a video to TikTok, which was a tutorial that answered the question, quote, how to answer the worst job interview question ever. And that question is, tell me about yourself. So what happened next? First of all, what's your answer to that? And then how did that snowball into you and I talking today?
It's a good question. Yeah, so I was working as a freelance video editor. You know, the film industry had kind of shut down, so I was really bored. And I hopped on TikTok like a lot of other millennials did. And I've always really, really loved giving career advice. And the film industry requires you to be really scrappy. So I just gathered a bunch of these great tips, and I just sat down and I posted, yeah, how to answer the worst job interview question, tell me about yourself. And I showed some like bad examples, which were pretty funny. And then I showed my template, a good example, which was past, present, future. So 2 to 3 sentences about your past, 2 to 3 sentences about your present, what you're currently doing, and then 2 to 3 sentences about your future and where you want to go. And I remember I just edited it like right on my phone, even though I'm a professional editor and I had a whole setup. I just did that, added some captions, and then I went to bed and I woke up and it had millions of views. And I was like, whoa, okay, there's something going on here.
Have you ever taken an improv class?
Maybe when I was younger. Yeah, I did theater when I was younger. Yeah.
That concept makes me think of an improv exercise that we teach here called 60-30-10. And often what we'll do is like, tell me about yourself in 60 seconds, and then we'll make you tell us about yourself in 30 seconds, and then you have to tell yourself in 10 seconds, because you never know what room you're going to be in or what the vibe is. And sometimes that calls for that full minute. And what's always interesting is when the 60 second happens, we're always like, who felt that was too much time? And that's half the group. And then the other people are like, it wasn't nearly enough time. You're like, okay, some people are not working with like all the stuff that they got available to them. And other people aren't aware of the other on that. And so this is what I love so much about your book, which is it is grounded in a very specific reality that you've existed in terms of your career, but also an understanding that when the context is different, everything else is different. That is against the business book trend of, hey, I'm going to give you 5 things that are guarantee your success.
Yeah, I'm a very new person. And you're right. That's one of the first things I talk about in the book. The first thing I say is like, hey, if I give advice and you feel weird about it or it feels unnatural to you, don't do it. It's important to be your personality.
Okay. One of the things that I realized when we started working in business schools across the country, and we've done a lot of work with those folks, is that they traditionally were not teaching anything that you would actually need to know when you get in business. Sales, relationships, whatever. And this is a thing you refer to, I think, as the hidden curriculum. So can you tell us what that is? Because that underlies the whole book.
So the hidden is a group of unspoken rules and etiquette that exist in the workplace. formally teaches you these things. There's no classes in college or high school about how to act in the job. These are traditionally, you have to learn from your community, and most people don't have access to those kinds of things. You can teach them these things. So they either have to learn hard knocks or actually don't learn at all. So many people never get their salary because they just, that's rude. Or maybe their parents even told them that's rude. But the hidden curriculum actually says, no, that's an etiquette in the U.S. professional culture in the United States. So the book is writing down these hidden rules and this hidden curriculum that no one ever formally taught you. But my whole thing is access to it. So the book is like, here it is.
So it's interesting. So we share a couple things, right? We're both Leos. We're both the youngest of six. That's a huge thing. I'm like double your age. I only figured out like maybe 10 years ago the stuff that you put in this book. So I don't know how you got so ahead of the curve. And there's a bit of revealing you do in the book because you write, quote, I have a zeal for creating meaningful change with a dangerous level of curiosity and a tragically open mind. I believe there is no one right way to do anything. Anyone who tells you they have all the answers and everyone else is wrong is selling you something, end quote. Where did this come from?
Yeah, I've read a lot of the business books. I have a lot of my favorite books behind. And I always just felt weird when people told me that there was a way to do something. I don't think that... that I always say in my followers is don't just take, seek advice from lots of wise, reputable sources, and then hear commonly repeated. Go with what you feel like. So yeah, I guess it's just part of maybe what why people like my brand is because I don't know everything. Just too, I hire and have to get hired. So yeah, I guess I'm just a bit more relatable and less of the type of author who's, you know, pretending that they know everything because no one knows what they're doing at the end of the day. I even have my mug says, no one knows what they're doing. So I think that while you should attempt to be a master of your craft and be really good at what you do, at the end of the day, we're all out here winging it and no one knows what tomorrow brings.
So also, this is something I suspect, which is this youngest of six thing. So for me, I got to see the five others screw up just royally over time and observe in a very safe place, not being the one who did that. And then also seeing what maybe worked for them. And I don't know about you, but like my siblings are like radically different. You would have no idea that we were actually related to each other. Cause it's just like, and you know, and I remember too, this is just funny because my dad was a radio TV guy here in town and he got free records. Like, so every Friday he'd come home with a stack of records and my brothers, we went in order. So it was oldest to youngest. So I got the last ones, which were all the new artists because they didn't know who they were. So inevitably, it was like, you know, 2 years later, because I'm going to show my age now, like I've got the Elvis Costello, the Joe Jackson, the, you know, like U2. They didn't know who U2 was. And they're trying to trade me Bob Marley and Eric Clapton records for this stuff. But it was all in this sort of unique viewpoint. So do you look at your family dynamics as something that might have influenced this?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. It's funny. When you grow up the youngest of such a big family, it's exactly what you described. You get to watch everybody else try out things and then learn from their mistakes. And one thing that I never really got to do was like make my own mistakes. Like I had all my older siblings constantly giving me advice, you know, unsolicited feedback most of the time about what I should be doing with my life. And, you know, you don't really get to make a lot of mistakes. And part of me is grateful that I don't have too many regrets in my life because of their mentorship and direction. However, I didn't really get to learn a lot of things on my own, you know, because a lot of them are telling you, don't do this, do that, don't do this, do that. I did this. And they put a lot of advice and feedback onto you. So maybe, you know, that's why I like giving advice is because I've been given advice my whole life. So mm-hmm. I like to be the big sister because I never got to be that. I was always the little sister who was, as you know, being the youngest of six, you're the smallest in the room. You're the youngest in the room. You're the quietest in the room. You're the dumbest in the room all the time. And so I'm grateful because I got a lot of advice and feedback and direction. And I said mentorship. They're still all mentors to me in different ways. But I very much like now being the one who can actually give advice and give back to other people.
Totally the same thing with me. So you write about an internship that was basically a bust. This is when you were a freshman. And you note that you say, quote, it took me years to realize that to a great extent, this was my fault, end quote. How so?
Yeah, my first, let's see, production internship. The company was fine and the people that worked there were fine. But I signed up for this internship and I wasn't clear about what I wanted. I didn't speak what I wanted into existence. I don't think I knew what I wanted. And I don't think I knew it was available to me. That's actually a problem that I see a lot is people actually don't even know the opportunities that are available to them. So they can't speak up and raise their hand and say, I want to do X, because they don't even know that X exists. I remember applying for this internship and it was a development internship in the film industry. And I didn't know what the word development meant at the time. I was like, what does that like come afterwards when they're developing the film? Like I had no clue what it even meant. So that's why the book is so important, is it just lays the groundwork, you know, for the stuff that everybody should know, but a lot of people just don't know. And so I go to this internship and they just give me total grunt work, just like busy work. And I didn't know what to do because I wasn't learning and I kind of felt like I was wasting my time, but I just didn't know how to speak up because I told them I would do anything in the internship interview. I told them I would sweep the floors. So I couldn't complain about them giving me, you know, tedious Excel spreadsheets to organize. But I was really frustrated at the same time because I could have been using that time to work a job that paid me. You know, this was an unpaid internship. And so that was kind of the moment when I realized, like, there's things I want to communicate and I don't know how to communicate them. And I'm going to become the master of communication. And you can't wait for somebody else to come give you your dream job or your dream opportunity. You have to learn how to advocate for yourself and speak up for yourself.
I did an informational interview with someone yesterday. So this is a friend of the family of an alum who had contacted me and said, could you meet with this kid? And I was so impressed, and not because of like, you know, I was impressed because they didn't know necessarily what they wanted to do, but they had a compass and that compass was pointing in a place like Second City. It was like, I might want to be a writer. I might want to be an improviser. I might want to go, that's great. Because you know what? You have to cross train. And I think this is true. I mean, certainly our industries, film, television, entertainment, all that. But I think most, because everything's so disrupted right now. The skill that you can walk into any business with is, do I ask good questions, good prompts? Do I know how to build relationships? And can I navigate uncertainty? If you've got those three things, everything else can kind of be learned, whether, you know, but those sort of essentials are completely necessary, because it's not like when I was growing up where it's like, oh, these 15 jobs will always be the 15 jobs. It's like, not anymore, man.
Nope. No. And especially in the age of AI, you know, sometimes people ask me, why didn't you write a book on AI? And I'm like, because AI is covered.
Yeah.
AI is taking on more technical skills every second of the day. It's getting better. It's like duplicating in what it can do. But one thing that it can never, ever, ever do is talk human to human. And interpersonal skills are the number one most in-demand skills that companies are looking for right now, because one, a lot of people don't have them. A lot of people don't know how to talk to other people.
No. Nope.
And they don't know how to work with people that they don't necessarily get along with, or they assume ill intent, or they don't know how to get through or communicate their ideas. And number two is AI is taking on a lot of these technical skills. So, you know, if half your job is technical and half your job is dealing with people and the technical stuff is getting eaten up by AI, you really got to learn how to communicate. That is the most valuable skill set right now. So that's why my book is so important, is teaching people how to talk to other people in a way that's authentic and effective to them and get some desired outcome. So yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot that I could say there.
So I had a pet peeve a while ago. It's no longer a pet peeve. But when people would contact to have me go speak at their organization, you know, it's like, oh, creativity, innovation, leadership, teamwork, all those things make sense. And then they would say, do you do storytelling? And I would sort of like bristle a little bit, which is kind of silly because all I do is tell stories. That is what I am actually known for. But I never thought of myself as someone who could teach storytelling. As I sort of dug into what storytelling is, and I think you've done this work, is that it's not just about like spinning a yarn. It's also about, what story are you telling yourself about who you are, what you might be able to be? And those self-defeating stories seem to lay at the heart of any contemporary dysfunction that we've got going for us. And I mean this writ large at the political crap that's going on in the country. And I mean it with Barb three doors down, who's having a bad day.
Yeah. The story that we tell ourselves about ourselves, it will determine the entire quality of your life. So many people have a story where the power is taken away from them. And I always tell people, and this is why I think the first or second chapter of the book is dedicated to self-awareness and mindset, is that if everybody's dealt a hand of cards, and some people are dealt a royal flush, And most people are dealt a mediocre hand, and some people are dealt a really, really bad hand. You have no control what hand you're dealt in life, but you have 100% control how you play those cards. So some people have an advantage right off the bat, and some people have a huge disadvantage, but most people have a normal hand. And so you can choose to tell a story where you're the victim and you're not going to thrive and you're not going to succeed and you're not going to be happy because of the cards that you were dealt. Or you can tell a story where you are going to be the hero and you're going to be a role model to other people and show people it doesn't matter the cards that you're dealt because you can play them really well. And that's a complete choice. Like, the world doesn't make that up for you. That's all in your head. And so I always encourage people to be their own role model, to be their own best friend, to be the hero of their own story, and don't wait for other people to come in and swoop you off your feet and be your hero. You got to step up to the plate and be the hero of your own story. So it's all about that story that you tell, especially like even like when you go in before a job interview. If you go in saying, why are they interviewing me? Like, I don't belong in this interview. You just took away all your power and you're not going to get the job. But if you go in saying, I'm a great fit for this role. They saw my resume and they loved it. And this is just a meet and greet. This is a culture thing. I'm going to knock these questions out of the park. Now, that's something that you can work with. People really don't realize how powerful the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves are. So I'm glad that you brought that up.
Yeah. And it's stories. It's also just words. So when you're talking, I think it's in chapter 2 on some of the communication hacks that you sort of talk about for people, I was reminded of an exercise I love that we do for people in the space. And the exercise is called Just End Little. So what we have is a person, much like the 60-30-10, where they sort of describe your job or your career. And then we have the person who's just heard that repeat it back to them, but inserting the words just and little throughout of it. So they're like, okay, so you just do this little thing and you're just this and little, and you just realize it's terrible to do because you feel horrible. So that's good because you're learning never do that. And for the person receiving that, you're like, you have just deflated everything that I offered to you. But we do that to others and we do it to ourselves. And as you say, it's filler. But what you're doing by doing that filler is you're also reducing agency for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. The last thing that you want to do is take power yourself. And, you know, it has a lot to do with raised. You know, if you're raised around people who speak like that, you know, how you taught to operate, it's so important. That's why the first chapter, because I told my ed in the beginning, they were kind of like, wow, whole chapter on like mindset. Like, because there's no, and teaching people if there's nothing behind them, if there's no confidence behind them, you can't go into a negotiation believing that you're going to everything in your life act against you in that negotiation. Believe that money out there and person and negotiating is comp, you know, you have to reset your mindset and snap that on and off. That's every single day of your confidence. So yeah, it's very, very important.
All right, let's get to something else that's really important, which is don't write crappy emails. This is now here's the thing. Like, you know, you grew up and there was email, right?
Yeah.
I grew up and there was no email. So at a certain point, I mean, I've told this story before at Second City, we got, this is like 1990 something. And a kid who was in the teen troupe wired the Second City for this thing called the internet. Like, and so this all saved God. And I'm realizing, like, no one ever taught me to write an email. No, I don't think anyone ever taught you. I'm very confused by this because it is the mode of communication in all business. So you have 4 steps to writing better emails. Can we go through the 4?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I'll prompt you.
Okay.
So number 1, get the basics right. What do you mean?
I mean, it's just like what you said. We never class or a course, there's so much professional etiquette where it should be written down somewhere. There should be one universal resume template that everybody uses, but there's not. It's just everything by trying to figure out what's wrong. And it's the same thing with emails, is we have a universal standard. And it also changes from company to company. That I talk about, companies have a really written communication style. Others have a more buttoned up. So of course it depends on your industry. But as far as the basics go, yeah, have a strong subject line that communicates exactly what you want. Keep it short. I think I say if it's over like 5 to 10 sentences, it should be a phone call. You know, just kind of like the basic things there. It's all written out in the book because it's not written out anywhere else.
Yeah. You also say, as a general rule, written communication at work is for giving or asking for information. That's it. Don't try to brainstorm, engage in debate, or have a discussion in writing. So that's, again, that's a basic thing that people don't understand. Yeah, get across.
Yeah, and it's because we made it up. You know, I mean, that's the best way that email isn't for going back and forth. Email is for communicating information or asking for information. That's it.
Okay, number two, create a professional address and signature. This seems simple. It's not. I remember this was just the other day. So you can probably imagine, for someone like myself who's worked at a place like Second City for so long, the amount of emails I get from people who have really good ideas that they think that we should invest in. And I had a guy, there was no, like, it was his Gmail, and he's like, look, I'm an accomplished filmmaker. I've got this idea for this documentary, blah, blah, blah. And there's nothing in his address. And then I'm like, I don't know, like, is about this. I wasn't even going to respond. I did. And he's like, I've got representation. And I'm like, oh, great. Have that person get in touch with me. The representation was also a Gmail.
Oh, no. Yeah. Yeah.
His representation was in the other room, and it was his roommate, I'm sure. And I'm like, okay, so that's kind of what you're talking about, right? Like, tell me who you are in this context.
Yeah, it's like showing up to an interview in sweatpants. It's like, it's just so easy to put on some slacks, you know? And again, I don't think a lot of people realize how much weight having a professional email address and professional email signature can carry. I mean, yeah, you can be a one-person company out there and have a company email address through Google, and then you can have a really professional looking signature, and no one will even suspect that it's just you playing all those different roles. It's so
That's
easy.
Right. All right. Number three is, and you mentioned this, but let's go into it because it's related to bluff, which I've talked about before on the podcast. Create clear subject lines. So
yeah.
Talk about bluff, because maybe people didn't listen to that episode.
Yeah. So bluff stands for bottom line up front. It's a military term that they actually developed to like save lives, but now corporations use it to streamline communication. So it stands for, I do this all the time, and I write emails and then I rewrite them. So I usually write them first and then I bluff them. So what we typically do when we write an email is like we write, hey, John, and then we write like an explanation and all this context. And at the bottom we put, and can you do this? What bluff says we should do is put the ask at the very top, and like I like to bold it and make it really clear, and then put the context underneath. So they know the ask is right away, and then they can read the context. And it's just a nice thing to do. People are really, really appreciative when you put a little bit of time and energy. I mean, I think we all have worked with that boss who sends a, okay, thanks, send for my iPhone. And it's just like, it feels so careless. And it's not, you know, if it was a text, it would seem fine. But in an email format, it just feels like they didn't respect you or your time. Or when somebody forwards you an entire email chain, it just says, please advise. And you're like, I have to read this whole thing. It feels inconsiderate. And so bluff is such an easy way to, again, you can write your normal email and then bluff it at the end. And it's just a really nice way of saving somebody else some time and being a bit more considerate with your communication. And people remember that stuff. And they like to recommend people who are strong communicators.
Yeah. And that leads me to the last one, which is keep it concise, which is every single thing that you just talked about. Like I had a playwriting teacher once, and I've used this line a million times and it still resonates for me, which is she told me, if you can't tell me your play in a sentence, you don't have a play. Keep it concise. And if you can't for some reason, you have not vetted your own brain in terms of what you want this communication to achieve.
Yeah, it's like in the film industry, you have a log line, which is a one sentence explanation of your film. In business, you have your elevator pitch, which is, you know, your 30-second pitch, like you mentioned before, of who you are and what you're doing. The ability to communicate concisely is rare. Most people ramble. Most people go on and they over-explain, and it's because they want to cover all their bases and they're scared that if they don't say enough words that they will be unsuccessful. But the opposite is true. You have to learn how to be concise and respect people's time. And people really appreciate that. They appreciate you putting a bit more time into these emails. And actually, this is a great way that AI can help. It can help you if you have a lot of trouble rambling in your emails to make them more concise, because people just won't read a long email. They'll skim it.
I'm sort of curious, like I'm doing a tangent here, because we've mentioned AI a few times. The creative class that I am a part of is not into AI. Like, and they're really mad with the people right now who are doing the Facebook like cartoons of themselves. They're very mad about this. And
I understand that.
You haven't heard about this? So Facebook, apparently, I haven't done it because I don't want to get yelled at. by older alumni of Second City. But Facebook has an AI thing where you can, it'll make a cartoon version of you that will, if you're a Cubs fan, you'll be wearing a Cubs hat. If you work at a place, it'll maybe have that logo behind you. And everyone's putting this up, and then everyone's yelling at people who are doing it. And then you've got, I just saw a report this morning that there's a study on these large language models that's showing that they're still hallucinating a lot of the time, and they're wrong. And I understand all of that in column A. And then also in column B, I have found a very useful way of using AI to help organize information for myself, to extend my personal brainstorming, not replace it, because it's so essential to do. As a young person, I imagine you're going to say you have a little easier time handling the technology, but I'm just curious, what's your AI attitude these days?
Oh, loaded question, Kelly.
I know.
AI everywhere. So I don't see AI as like a new feature. I see AI as a scientific discovery. I think it's like we discovered water on the moon and we're all trying to figure out what does this mean for humanity. It's a really, really big deal. It's very overblown in the short term, and I think it's extremely underblown in the long term. We've already seen AI capabilities just in the past 2 years get so much better. And I think we still have another 5 years of slop and hallucinating and ethical dilemmas and real questions. And yeah, I think the creative industry is really grappling with some very, very tough realities right now. And I know that, you know, I came from the film industry. My husband's a graphic designer. Like, this is very personal to us. Mm-hmm. At the same time, but my feelings on AI don't change anything. We discovered water on the moon. Like, it's just here and it's here to stay. And my case for people to care about AI and embrace it is that if good people with consciences and ethics choose to abstain from AI, it will only hurt it because, yeah. Or it'll only hurt humanity, because then the weirdos are going to have control over it and they're going to do weird things with it. And that's like the worst case scenario, because like with any new powerful technology, like the internet or computers, they can be used for great good and great evil. So we have to make sure that we use AI for great good, because it could potentially solve climate change, solve world hunger, solve finding a cure for cancer. It could potentially do all these things. But if good people aren't using it to do those things and we're abstaining because we think if we close our eyes, it'll go away, it's just not going to happen. So I'm like you. I like to try. I'm AI curious, as I call it. I like to try and find ways that it can make my work more efficient. But I have tried to use it to like write or do anything creative, and it is so bad at it.
Terrible.
And even if you think it's good, it's not. It's crushing your creativity. This is original. AI will never ever be able to replicate this, or your head too. I'm poking your head. In short, those are my thoughts. I tend to write a lot more on my LinkedIn and Substack about AI because it is something that I think about all day, every day.
No, that's an A-plus answer. My wife's a college professor, right? So, and she teaches in this comedy major. So she can I can tell you right now, the AI is not good at analyzing The Honeymooners or Lucille Ball or Silent Movie. So it's like, she's at me, like, everything that's in here is nothing that was in my class. So, you know, I can tell when you, and luckily, I will say, the people who are attracted to a comedy major are generally people who are interested in inventing and inventing for their own POV, so that they too can look at it as like, no, I want to have my list. And then if I need help in terms of exploring, I can use this technology. All right. Your networking chapter. I love how you opened this chapter. You say, in this chapter, we're going to talk about networking. Wait. Don't put down the book. No, stay with me here. And I feel like this is written for my wife, who is such an introvert. And when she has to go to these conferences, it's just a nightmare. So how do you make people less scared around networking?
Introvert myself, it really exhausts people. A very limited view of what networking is, again, because it's a hidden curriculum. So they think it's like, I have to go to the stuffy like hotel room and drink out of a styrofoam and like put on a name tag, awkwardly stand in the hotel, somebody comes up to me. And yeah, that's one form of networking, being at your cousin's wedding and talking to their future wife's aunt who happens to work at the company you want to work for. Like that's my favorite kind of networking. Network friends in a professional way. That's all it is. Impressing people and work. My favorite way to network at the dog park, birthday parties, just making friends. They work in your industry, don't, they probably have friends who do. It's just expanding your circle and can. So different ways you can network, context networking, and try to help ways that work for them. There's also networking, which is when you on LinkedIn and you find people that, you know, went to your university or maybe that you were in the same for, and you message them, hey, like, I just want to introduce you. There are so many ways to aren't cringy at all. It's just probably nobody's taught you yet. And I always tell people, like, when they're afraid of networking, it's probably just because no one do it right. So it is really cringy. You actually are being and so there are ways you're not being really normal. And yeah, I mean, we went through a pandemic and, like, leave our houses for a year. So I think that really hurt some people who were in their ability to, like, actually speak. And so that chapter is really important to me, just teaching, like, especially people, just how to, like, professionally somebody.
Yeah, it's a bad word. So you mentioned COVID, and, you know, we shut down here for like a year. We're the first theater to reopen, and, you know, and we shifted, and I gave keynotes, you know, on Zoom in my underwear in my attic. But one of the things that we sort of realized, even though, you know, we went from like 700 employees to like 39 at a certain point, was that we had to create a form of connection. And what we ended up doing was every Friday at 3 o'clock, we hosted like a 15-minute, like, just Zoom get together. And there was no agenda. I co-hosted it with my friend Abby. And we did a lot of bits, and we celebrated some successes, and then everyone got to, like, you know, chime in if they had things. And that was it. There was always a playlist, and there was something. And so we did that through COVID. And then when we came back, we stopped it. And one of the things that maybe a year in, we're like, you know, I know we're back together, but don't feel like we're completely back together. And we're like, oh yeah, because a bunch of people are still remote, and there's other people that, because we've moved offices in the building and other people aren't here, we just started up again. And it is so joyous. And in part of the joy is it's not named a thing like networking. I think we're calling it Yes App for some reason right now. And I don't even know, you know, that, but that's what it is. And so it is, it's almost like you have to design purposeful play for yourself when it is not being designed for you. And that's often.
Yeah, I love that. And yeah, it's funny. I follow this other creator who's a friendship expert, and she's like, people ask me, why is it so easy to make friends when you're a kid? And it's like, because your parents are pushing you into these social atmospheres. They push you to school, and they push you to go to the playground, and they push you to do play dates, and they're organizing your social calendar. But when you're an adult, it's up to you. You need to get out of your house and talk to other people. So I really love that you brought that up.
Okay, before I ask you for your Yes And story, I'm well known around Second City for, you know, I have the podcast, so I read the book, but then I always talk about it with other people. And so we had a recent podcast with a woman who was talking about the danger of plastics. I don't know if you listened to that one, but I recommend it because it's important, but also I'm sorry, because you're never going to look at the black plastic in your kitchen in the same way. And I've had so many of my colleagues be like, I had to throw out all that black plastic. Thank you. Like, so I know black plastic is bad.
Okay. Especially in the kitchen. I'll listen to that one.
I'm thinking of all these
contractor bags that I have.
I know. So this line from your book was very controversial in our leadership meeting, because I opened the leadership meeting with,
I love Kelly controversy.
Okay, good. So this is, I started saying Kelly read a book, which is the way we joke about what I do. And what you say, quote, is, my hot take, which you may disagree with, is that you shouldn't be friends with your coworkers, end quote.
Yeah, that was one of those lines where I put in there where I'm like, ooh, this is going to be spiky. I then go on to talk about it, of course. Here's the problem with giving career advice is you're talking to everybody. So you're giving general advice for specific scenarios. I think you should absolutely be friendly with your coworkers. I have very, very, very good friends who I've met at work. I just don't think being friends with your coworkers should be your number one priority. I think working with your coworkers should be your number one priority, and that you should just have different conversations with them than you would have with your friends. Because your friends, you know, if they piss you off, you can just stop being friends with them. But your coworkers, you got to work with regardless. So I make the case for professional speak because it helps people create boundaries at work. And I think that boundaries are really important, because I see when boundaries aren't used at work that people can get themselves into trouble. And it's not a good way to advocate for yourself. But to be clear, I think it's perfectly fine to be friends with people that you work with if you want to.
So can you take a stab or a guess at when I sat down with Shannon, who runs HR, and said to me, what do you think when I say this? What she said back to me?
She probably agreed.
She was half and half. So I think she got your nuance. So she's like, I understand the nuance. However, when I look at my list of like my 10 best friends, 8 of them I met at jobs.
And it's true. Psychologically, if you have a best friend at work, your job satisfaction goes up by like 70%. Most of adults meet their adult best friends at work. So that's why like I'm really a fan of people going into the office when they're younger, especially in their 20s, because I'm like, guys, this is where you can meet your future spouse, and you're not gonna have that connection with them over Zoom. So I'm like really a huge fan of social interaction at work in person. What I mean in the book is the friendship should be secondary to the working relationship. I see a lot of people who go to work and they try to be friends with everybody. And you're not at work to be friends with everybody. You're work to work with people. If somebody becomes a friend, that's great. But that's not like what you're there to do.
Yeah. I think that we can appreciate the nuance. Okay.
Yeah, there's a lot of nuance there.
So
my work besties are listening, like, we're not friends.
So said meeting that I read that out before, and this is just last week. So mm-hmm. It was our Wednesday leadership meeting. So it is the top leaders in the company. And I opened by reading that out. We had a good laugh and everyone sort of chimed in. And then my boss, Ed, said, interesting that you bring that up because I'm announcing today that I'm leaving the company. So I literally like pulled up the chapter about, you know, how to quit your job gracefully to him. We had a good laugh out of it. But I will say this, he did what you recommended. And I'm sad because like really he's actually become a friend. He's a good friend.
Yeah.
And he's a very good leader. And he was a leader before he was a friend. And that's what I appreciate. But he left with joy. He left with, you know, clarity. And, you know, like, and he and I would talked about this before about like, you know, I've probably worked here the longest of anyone except for my wife. And Ed is pretty senior in terms of different roles, younger than me, but still senior. And it's like the thing we learned early on is don't burn bridges. There is just like, it will never benefit you. You have no idea if that person who you have had a connection with is going to go on, they're going to be somewhere that you could be of help to them and they could be of help to you. It's like, why would you not maintain your army?
Yeah. Yeah. Again, talking to different audiences, most people leave jobs on good terms. However, sometimes people, especially when they're younger, think the world is so big and they're never going to see these people again. They think that people are just going to stay at that company forever, but people don't. They leave their company and you'd be surprised how many people you run into again, especially if you work in a smaller industry or a smaller region. The more people that you can get to like you, like in life and the world, I mean, the more opportunities are just going to start falling into your lap. So yeah, why make an enemy when you really don't have to? And also most people have really good intentions. And so something I talk about a lot in the book is giving people the benefit of the doubt. Like everybody's doing their best most of the time. They have internal demons, they have internal battles going on. That's why I say like when you go to work, you're at work, put on your work hat. You're not there to be anybody's therapist. Like when you go with a group of friends and somebody's having problems, you are kind of like their therapist. Like you do kind of have to be their friend and be there for them. When you're at work and somebody's having problems, it is not your job to fix their problems. If your boss is like got some weird projection problem, it's not your problem to fix that. It's your problem to do your job. You know, it's your job to do your jobs. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot in the book on that.
Yeah. I'm obsessed with this line that Morgan Housel's brother-in-law gave to him when we had Morgan on the podcast, which is everyone's behavior makes sense if you have enough information.
I love that. Isn't that so great?
I've never heard anyone phrase that in quite that way, but you're like, of course, everyone's behavior makes sense if you have enough information. You just don't have the information.
I say, don't get mad, get curious. Like if somebody's acting weird and your immediate reaction is to getting a bit defensive, I instead am like, what happened in your childhood that made you
exactly
this way?
That's how you deal with hecklers. I mean, there's industries that have taught us how to deal with stuff. All right.
Yeah,
I could talk to you forever. You're the best. But we always ask the last question of a first-time guest is, do you have a yes and story? You know, a time in your life where maybe you were going to say no, but you said yes. And then what happened?
Yes. And before we end real quick, I just want to say that I actually went to one of the first Second City shows after y'all opened up after the pandemic. You just reminded me of that. And it was great. So I just wanted to say that before we close out real quick. I love Second City. Chicago.
Were you in Chicago? You're in Chicago?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Were you at one of the shows where you had to wear a mask and we're in like little pods in the audience? Oh my God, that was so weird.
We had to wear a mask, but I think they were serving cocktails because I think I got pretty drunk at that. I didn't mean to. They were really strong.
It was like your first time out. Right. And that was like one of the first, we were the first theater in Chicago to reopen. And so that, like, that was not a thing at that time. That was new to all of us.
Yeah. It was great though, to be in a room with people again, just like making jokes.
I know. I was there. Anyway. It was, yeah. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, of course. I love Chicago. My yes and story, though, is it's kind of a funny one. I think it was a year ago. I get a lot of DMs. I get like sometimes hundreds or even like thousands of direct messages a day on like TikTok and Instagram. And a lot of them will go to my request folder. So like they get filtered out and I don't see them. And I'll go through there and see if I missed anything. And I got this one message from this guy. And it seemed like a sketchy message at first. He was like, hey, like I heard about you and I want to set up a call. And usually I would ignore that. I'd be like, no. But I had this like yes and moment where I was like, something about this doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem very sketchy to me. So I responded to him. Long story short, it resulted in the largest deal in my career. And I haven't announced it yet. It's going to be announced next month, hopefully. But if I hadn't said yes and like to that message, I never would have, you know, discovered this guy or this deal, this relationship. So that was definitely a moment where I went against the grain of what I would normally do. And thank God I did, because it was a great partnership.
When we had Dan Pink on the podcast last, it was his book on regret. And overwhelmingly, we don't regret the things we do. We regret the things that we didn't do. Mm-hmm. And yes, I've taken a crappy meeting, but you know what? That ends up being an awesome story.
Is what I say.
Yep. The book is called The Secret Language of Work, Hyper Helpful Scripts for Every Situation. Erin McGough, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.